The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Received word that a plane apparently has crashed into the tower.
Something relatively devastating happening this morning.
There is more and more fire and smoke.
Another plane has hit Tower 2.
A horrific scene here. There's debris flying through the air.
Directly in the middle of one of the World Trade Center towers.
Both towers of the World Trade Center have been hit.
Next thing you know, we heard boom. We ran up to the corner and hit right into the World Trade Center.
Something that has happened here at the World Trade Center. We noticed flame and an awful lot of smoke from one of the towers of the World Trade Center.
Some sort of explosion. We don't fully know the details. There is one report, as of yet unconfirmed, that a plane has hit the World Trade Center.
Uncertainty right now as to what is happening. You can see there are choppers. I believe that could be a police helicopter that is... Oh!
Wow.
We just saw...
Oh, my goodness.
Another live picture right now.
Oh, my goodness.
Of what I believe was a plane that just hit another plane.
It does not appear that there's any kind of an effort up there yet. Now remember, oh my God.
That looks like a second plane.
I did not see a plane go in. That just exploded.
We just saw another plane coming in from the side.
Crashed into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York this morning.
Part of the Twin Tower obviously folding, coming crashing down. We're watching a live.
That's a 9/11 tribute, obviously. Here we are, 18 years on from the attack, September the 11th, 2001. If you're a senior in high school like my son, 17 years of age, you were born after that dreadful event. Everyone in high school, everyone in elementary school, most of the college students coming into AC this semester, They were born right around the time of that attack. It's important history for our young people, the oncoming generation, to remember. Joel Hilliker is going to be featuring or spotlighting this history on Trumpet Hour coming up after this program. He'll talk about the importance of remembering history. He'll look back at the immediate response to that tragedy, how that it momentarily united America and much of the world, really. And yet, look at where we are today. Look at the troubles that we, in many ways, as we'll see here from a New York Post article in just a second, look at so many of the troubles that we're just bringing on ourselves. Here, this was an attack. 18 years ago, it was an attack from without. And then many people rose up in defense of New York and the Pentagon. And those brave Americans on the plane that went down in Pennsylvania. That was in 2001, as many of you know. It was May 5th of that year that my father announced that we had entered into the last hour. He built that message around a prophecy in 1 John 2. And then just a few months after that message, the United States was attacked on September 11th. It was the worst terrorist attack ever on U.S. soil. Nearly 3,000 people were murdered on that day. And did that attack ever give us a sense of urgency, being that we're in the last hour? Many of you remember some of the articles we wrote early on in the war against, the so-called war against terrorism. I mentioned Mr. Hilliker, his program coming up. He had an article back in the late part of 2001, I think it was, where he talked about how that we were making a mistake not going after the head of the snake. And so many other articles that talked about America not having the will to win the war. Andy McCarthy, he had a piece in National Review just a few days ago talking about Afghanistan and the Taliban, and of course that's been in the news, the talks that President Trump called off because of these terrorist attacks. They continue. 18 years on, McCarthy says, in Afghanistan, the Taliban have greeted the announcement of a near-term U.S. withdrawal, not with reciprocal toasts to peace in our time, but with a series of terrorist attacks. It says, see what our government frames as peace talks, the Taliban are portraying as surrender. They're attacking because they want Afghans to believe they're driving the superpower out in humiliating defeat, just as their forebears drove out the Red Army, Russia or the Soviet Union, hastening the Soviet Empire's collapse. That's what they all believe is oncoming, the collapse of the American superpower. Jeremiah Jacques had a piece 5-6 years ago, Death by a Thousand Cuts, how that we're losing this war against the terrorists because they keep striking, and they're small strikes for the most part, but death by a thousand cuts, as he said. And then you look at what's happening within, as I said. This is from the New York Post. The U.S. feels divisive in 9/11 aftermath as memories of unity fade. It momentarily brought us together, Republicans, Democrats alike, singing God Bless America on the stairs of the Capitol. That was 18 years ago. No more unity today. The Post says the mourning and sense of common purpose that were so distinct then, speaking of 9/11, seem as if they happened in a different country, in a different century. Now our nation is not just polarized, it's fractured. It's not just a little bit of a divisive spirit. It's fully fractured, it says. I've never seen it like this, an elderly friend told me recently. This is from the Post. I'm afraid of what's happening to our country. And then this author says she's not alone. And while the 9/11 attack certainly didn't cause our bitter divisions, its ramifications are among the powerful forces still shaping our dangerous world. Here we are today, 18 years on, and now we're having to deal with self-inflicted wounds, a kind of self-inflicted 9/11. This author at the Post, he quotes from this resident of Manhattan, someone living there, someone who remembers 9/11 well, someone who rose up in defense of the city when it was attacked. And she writes, I write this on the eve of 9/11 because I'm looking at my city. I'm looking at my city now, and I'm horrified. The streets are filthy. The cops can't do anything. The homeless situation is beyond tragic. And there's a hostility and violence in the air that I've not felt since I moved to Manhattan 30 years ago. It says, to be honest, walking to work today, I thought to myself, why did I work so hard and choose to fight to stay here? Why did I work so hard to stay in New York City? This is what my city has become, a place for people who are not from New York, who are either extremely wealthy or extremely poor, a city where the rules no longer apply. And this columnist at the Post says, 18 years after its worst day, the city faces a new crisis. This one is self-inflicted. This is one we've brought on ourselves. And this is prophesied. This sickness. My father wrote in the Last Hour, this is the book about the subject I mentioned at the top, entering into the last hour in May of 2001, he said, in the beginning of America's history, listen to this, you'll hear more about the importance of history and how that we ought to remember it coming up at the Trumpet Hour following this program. It says, in the beginning of America's history, its goal was to establish God's rule on earth. Would you like to compare that goal with what we have become today? If only we would remember our history with God. My father says, when we refuse to learn from the past, we can't see into the future. We lose the overview and we become blind. We're forgetting our past. We're forgetting this history. We're forgetting the lessons from this history. And now look at the self-inflicted wounds. 18 years after its worst day, New York is facing a new crisis. And this one is self-inflicted. I just started reading my father's booklet on Isaiah, the prophet, his prophecy in the Old Testament there. And you look at the way Isaiah opens his book. He says, hear, O heavens, and give ear, O earth. The Lord has spoken, it says. I have nourished and brought up children, and they've rebelled against me. God is saying, hear, O heavens. This is a message, really, not just for the world, it's for the universe. It's going to impact the universe, ultimately. God says, I've nourished and brought up children, but they've rebelled against me. They've rebelled against their creator. They've rebelled against their father. They no longer have a father. It says in verse 3, the ox knows his owner and the ass his master's crib, but Israel does not know. My people does not consider. They don't know. They don't know their father. They don't honor the father. They forget the Father. Think about that history, as my father wrote about in the last hour. In the beginning of America's history, the goal was to establish God's rule on earth. No more talk about that. Oh, there's talk about religion. There's references to the Bible sometimes, but where is there any submission to the teachings of the Bible? Verse 4, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that are corruptors. They have forsaken the eternal. They've provided the Holy One of Israel, or provoked rather, the Holy One of Israel to anger. They've gone away backward. We've provoked our Father. We've corrupted ourselves. And verse 5 says, why should you be stricken anymore? You will revolt more and more. The whole head is sick, and the whole heart is faint, it says, from the sole of the foot, even unto the head. There's no soundness in it, but wounds and bruises and putrefying sores. They have not been closed, neither bound up, neither mollified with ointment. Sickness through and through. Sickness in our cities, in all of our big cities. And it's self-inflicted. And a lot of times the authorities, the commentators, the politicians, they just want to gloss over it and pretend it's not as bad as it really is. Richard had a story in the Stack today about these grooming gangs in Rotherham. And as he said, in the Me Too era, you would think this kind of news or this kind of report would get all kinds of coverage. Abusing little girls, after all. Abusing teenagers. In some cases, preteens. But over in the UK, they continue to turn a blind eye to it because, well, the perpetrators are Muslim. And so we have to pretend that it's not really that big of a problem. We don't want to offend the strangers that are taking over Rotherham and other cities like that. I use the terminology that Isaiah does. It's later on in chapter 1. This is from, I think it's The Spectator. It says, strikingly, the judge didn't only condemn the men, he also criticized the authorities in Rotherham. He said they had at best been totally ineffectual and at worst wholly indifferent to the abuse of girls by Muslim gangs. He said he was quite satisfied that the relevant authorities in Rotherham knew girls were being targeted for sexual exploitation, and their failure to do anything about it is a lamentable state of affairs. Spectator says this ought to be a huge talking point. There have been similar scandals in other parts of the country, in Telford, Rochdale, Oxfordshire, and elsewhere. In each case, gangs of men from largely Muslim backgrounds abused and exploited young women from mostly white working class backgrounds. And often there's evidence that the authorities were conscious of what was happening, but took little action against it. They were worried about being seen to demonize Muslims and possibly contributing to what they view as a culture of Islamophobia. Now that's just one of the symptoms of this sickness. There's so many. My father says in the last hour, we may be witnessing the worst hour ever. From now on, he said, we're in the last hour, a time like no other. We'll experience the worst turmoil and violence on earth. That's what this last hour is all about. The worst time ever. Now we're in the midst of a very temporary resurgence. It's written about in 2 Kings chapter 14. But even that, if you read that passage, it says that the Eternal saw the affliction of Israel, that it was very bitter. God saw our affliction. God saw our sickness. And so what did he do? Well, it says the Eternal said not that he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, but he saved them by the hand of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. He saved them temporarily, as my father has written. And so there's a temporary resurgence going on. It was interesting. One of our alert listeners sent me this clip from the other night. This was Donald Trump in a campaign rally in North Carolina. I think this was Monday night. And here he is referring to the resurgence. He actually used that word, clip two.
We're here tonight to discuss the extraordinary progress we're making as a nation and how to ensure this amazing resurgence keeps on going and going strong. In just over 2 years, we've taken this big, beautiful ship, and it's being turned around very quickly. Nobody thought this would happen.
And a lot has happened in 2 years' time or 3 years' time. But we can't be lulled into a false sense of security. Remember again what God said in 2 Kings 14. He intervened because he saw the affliction. He saw the sickness. He sees what we're doing to ourselves. And because of his mercy and love, he's brought this on, this temporary resurgence. Another opportunity for us to wake up and to learn from history, to learn the lessons from our own history. The affliction is still there. The sickness is still there through and through. And then you see, too, you see what the rest of the world is doing, largely in response to the current administration of the United States. Foreign Policy at a piece today. Europe is ready for its own army. It is ready. Foreign Policy says European leaders are already thinking about how to cope with a scenario where they face a resurgent empire to the east and a fading and no longer friendly superpower in the west. So you see, Europe, Foreign Policy, a lot of these publications, they see what's in the bigger picture. They see what's happening. They see the sickness. They see the affliction. They see what we're doing to our cities. They see a declining superpower. And it says, under these conditions, a real European army could emerge for the first time. For the first time. You see, Europe is getting ready. Europe sees what's happening in the rest of the world. Europe says they need an army. And of course, they're being led by Germany and France. It says some quarters of Europe, most prominently in French defense circles, have long aspired to a continental military force powerful enough to grant Europe a degree of autonomy in global affairs proportionate to its population and level of economic development. Now listen to this. Again, people have talked about this for years, I know. But action, they're beginning to take action. It says here, so it should not be surprising that France has been the first to call for the formation of a European army. What is new? Here's why it's going to accelerate. It says what is new is that most other Western European nations or countries agree, and most significantly that Germany agrees. Merkel agrees. Former German defense minister and incoming president of the European Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, she agrees. Merkel's appointed successor in the German center-right Christian Democratic Union Party, he agrees, it says. And Germany's main center-left party agrees. That last is especially unusual. The West German left has been the most opposed to anything military, for obvious historical reasons. But now you see they're all on board with it. Look, this is before. This is before the Daniel 8 man. They're all on board, and this article brings out, well, now with the UK leaving because of Brexit, there's no one in the EU to oppose it. Britain, of course, all along was against it. Britain was very much against it. But now Britain's leaving. And so the army is coming. Well, this article refers to the preliminary treaty that Britain, or rather that France and Germany, signed earlier this year. Just this year. A common military culture. So you've got France and Germany. They've agreed on this. Foreign policy says it's still, it is still early days, but right now the political will is there to make all this happen. And so long as Russia keeps escalating in the East, the United States remains an unreliable friend in the West. That determination will endure. It says if it endures long enough, Europe won't just be a continent. It'll be a military power that matches its economic clout. Think about all of those prophecies, all of those statements made by Herbert Armstrong for decades. A union, an economic union, a political union, and yes, a military union. He predicted all of it. Because he was grounded in the prophecies of God. Well, there's another story in the stack about Europe taking, again, practical steps forward. The EU's defense union, it's now getting its own staff, its own offices. I think Richard Palmer has talked about this before on the program. And speaking of foreign policy, there's another article in the same publication about Germany isn't special. And by that, it means that following its defeat in World War II, it was a special case. And it had to be kept down, so to speak. But now, foreign policy says it's time for Germany to buck its post-war policy traditions and begin to see itself for what it is, a normal power. That's what Germany is now, says foreign policy, and says so many of the policymakers in Europe. Well, you're just a normal power. And look at the world. Look at the resurgence of Russia in the East. Look at the decline of the United States in the West. And we need you, Germany. We need you to flex your muscles. You're just a normal power. Well, are they watching what's happening inside of Germany? The rise of these far-right parties? As I say, this is all before the fulfillment of Daniel 8. This is during the reign of Angela Merkel. The last days of Merkel's administration. Germany needs to go forward. Germany needs to lead Europe. Foreign policy says it's high time for Germany to shed its historical inhibitions, to strengthen its own democracy and the liberal international order. It's time, you see, for Germany to step up. Don't be lulled into a false sense of security. There's still a lot of affliction, a lot of sickness. It says so even in that passage about the resurgence. Herbert Armstrong wrote in the U.S. and Britain in Prophecy, "Do you think so great a fall could not come to so great powers as Britain and America? Do you say it can't happen here? Do you think the great God who was able to give them such unprecedented world leadership and power and wealth is not able to take it away? To take it away from them and throw them, like their ancient forefathers, back into slavery?" He says you need to open your eyes. You need to open your eyes and look at what's already happened to the great British Empire. and look at what's now happening to the United States. This gal that's quoted in that New York Post piece, here she's been a resident of New York for 30 years. She rose up in defense of New York City 18 years ago after the attack on 9/11. And now, 18 years on, now she wants to move out. She wants to get out. Because of all that's happened to her city and all of it, at least all that she's concerned about, as the New York Post brings out, it's self-inflicted. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Freedom is one of the most sought-after ideals in human history. Man's search for freedom has taken him into the fiercest of protests, struggles, revolutions, civil wars, even world wars. Today, in the midst of free societies, many continue to fight for what they perceive as ever greater freedoms. And yet, many of these same people are actively fighting against law. Few people understand that this war against law actually undermines true freedom. To learn more, request Gerald Fleury's booklet, No Freedom Without Law. In this free booklet, you will see what the Bible says about the latter-day spirit of rebellion and lawlessness that is now so common in our nations today. Also request America Under Attack. In this booklet, you will learn more about the spirit behind this attack on law. You'll see where this is leading. Both booklets are offered freely at no cost or obligation to you. Request No Freedom Without Law and America Under Attack. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. Trumpet Daily.
A couple of people have sent me this article about dating, a new study on those young people who hold off on dating and how that in doing that they tend to develop better social skills. They're less depressed. Surprise, surprise. Of course, by dating, they're not talking about dating in the godly sense. Dating widely, group dates, growing, you know, socially, becoming more outgoing, developing your personality. By dating, they're talking about going steady dating. Herbert Armstrong writes about this in The Missing Dimension in Sex. The evils, all the bad fruits that resulted from that custom, an American custom, started after the great wars of the early 20th century. World War I, World War II, the custom of steady dating, as Mr. Armstrong says in MDS, once the 18 and 19-year-olds started doing it, then the 14 and 15-year-olds wanted to do it. So by dating, they're saying those who refrain from going steady or from a romantic experience, in other words, a sexual activity, those who abstain from that, they're likely to have better social skills and to be less depressed. How about that? Another study. It always takes a costly study to prove the Bible true. And, of course, the Bible's never given any credit. The Bible's not even considered. This is from Study Finds. It says, surprisingly, the study's authors discovered that non-dating students had either similar or better interpersonal skills than their dating classmates. Furthermore, while self-reported positive relationship scores did not differ between either groups, teachers rated the non-dating students significantly higher than their romance-seeking classmates in terms of social and leadership skills. Well, the teacher said it's significantly higher. It's so much better. As for depression, it says teachers also rated non-dating students as less depressed. Additionally, far fewer abstinent students reported feeling depressed or hopeless regularly than students who were known to date. It reminds me, we've been going through dating in the last few lectures of Principles of Living, but it reminds me of this this article by Timothy Foote from back in the early 80s, The Trouble with Harvard. And he talks about just even all of the promiscuity that was going on the campus back in the 80s. It's much worse today in the hookup culture. In any event, he talked about just the exhaustion, the mental exhaustion going from one sexual relationship to the next. And how that these students, they're in with one counselor after another, and then in one relationship to the next, they can't even focus on their studies. And what a distraction it is for others who are there trying to actually study. There's trouble at Harvard. That's according to a Harvard grad from, I think he graduated in the 60s. He was writing about Harvard in the 1980s. Mr. Armstrong's last version of The Missing Dimension in Sex was 1981. What would they say today, these authors? It says, in summary, we found that non-dating students are doing well and are simply following a different and healthy development trajectory than their dating peers. So those who abstain from sexual activity, they're on a healthy track, says this study. Well, here at God's College, they're on that healthy track and they are dating widely. They are dating actively, our young people. They're taught about the laws of dating. I just gave our students a coworker letter, or I'm not sure if this went to all of the coworkers. I think it just went to the students at God's College. This was back in the 1960s. Herbert Armstrong wrote this in 1963, and he was talking here about a problem at AC where some of the students were saying that they loved so-and-so and then calling off the engagement at the last minute when some other opportunity came along. And Mr. Armstrong said he talked about the policy he established at the college that you're not to date toward marriage until you're near the end of your senior year. Prior to that time, you're to date widely. You're to spread yourself around. Not sexually, but socially. But he says here in this article, can't I make our students understand what a serious matter marriage is? Marriage is serious. Marriage is a career. He says it's not for children. It's not for the immature adolescent who imagines himself to be a man. It's not for a college freshman of normal age of 19 or under, as yet unprepared to support a wife and family. He says that's why we put on the pressure for all such underclassmen until about the middle of the senior year to put marriage out of mind. You see, here at the college, God's College, we're very much pro-marriage and family. We love it. We love seeing young people build happy families. But this is something that they prepare for. They must prepare for it because it's a career, marriage. It's your life in so many ways. And it's the way that we prepare for God's kingdom, for God's family. There's a season, as I've been saying to the students, And it's important. It's important that when you're out of season, so to speak, or when it's not the time for marriage, that you be far away from it, just as it says in Ecclesiastes chapter 3. Ecclesiastes 3, I'll just read these few verses for you. Chapter 3, this is the passage where Solomon's writing about a time for this, a time for that. Verse 1, it says, to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, it says, a time to break down and a time to build up. It says a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. It says a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. Or as it says there in the margin, to be far from embracing. Every time I mention that margin reference, it gets a chuckle out of the freshmen as I tell them, you're in the season. This season for you, right now, as a 19-year-old, this is the time that you're to be far from embracing. And yet, they're here as freshmen and they're learning how to date God's way. They're learning about the laws of dating as a freshman in college. And this isn't material when we start going through Missing Dimension in Sex and studying what Mr. Armstrong wrote in that book. It's not like it's premature that we get into that subject. Because they're 4, 5, 6, maybe 7 years away from marriage. Now is the time to go through that material. Now is the time to prepare. Mr. Armstrong, before Missing Dimension in Sex came along, he wrote, God speaks out on the new morality. And this is a point he brings out in the 1964 version of that book. He said, since the establishment of this Principles of Living course, beginning in 1949, including classes in general family relations and child rearing, hundreds of students have married who previously had taken this course. He says there has not been one instance in all of that number of unhappiness due to sex incompatibility. He says there has not been one single divorce. That's just a little window of 15 years, 1949 to 1964. And all of these hundreds and hundreds of students that went through Principles of Living, as he says, there are not one instance of divorce. I was telling the students just yesterday, it's easy to take it for granted, but here they're going in front of an instructor every day at class who's most likely, I guess I didn't go through every single person on our faculty list, but I think every one of them is married, has been for a long time, has children. This is a wonderful environment to learn about marriage and family, to prepare for marriage and family, to prepare for marriage by dating God's way, by bringing God's revelation into your dating life. Hosea 4 and verse 6 says that our people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. There's knowledge everywhere, but we've forgotten God. We've rejected God's knowledge. We've rejected God's revelation. It says in that same passage, Hosea 4 and verse 7, as they were increased, so they sinned against me. Therefore will I change their glory into shame. As we've multiplied, as we've increased, so have our sins. God looks at our nations today, and what does he see? He sees a lot of affliction. He sees a lot of sickness. So much so that he's granted us a temporary resurgence. Economically, mostly. Prosperity, that kind of thing. But look at the sickness. It's still there. And when you look around at our society, you see just how unique and special God's church is. You see just how unique and special Armstrong College is. You look at the training that our young people are receiving. You look at the laws that they're expected to uphold. Why so much division and strife in our nations today? Why are families shattering? Marriages? Why are there so many divorces and unhappy marriages? Well, there's all kinds of root causes. And they're prophesied. The role reversals in the home, Isaiah 3. Weak men that won't step up and lead. Selfish parents. Selfish husbands and fathers. Deadbeat dads. Mothers who are fleeing the home for the workplace. Children who are left to themselves. The sins of adultery, fornication, that sort of thing. You could go on and on with so many of these problems, but certainly one that doesn't get enough coverage is the ungodly dating practices that are just widely accepted now. It's just routine. You get a study finds report every once in a while, like the one I just referred to. But for the most part, the educators, the scholars, the parents, the adults, they all agree that, well, everyone's doing it, so we just need to be supportive of it. Teach them how to do it safely, I guess. I'll refer you back to that program we did on Friday. Pornography, is it harmful? Well, more and more are saying, no, it's not really that harmful. It's just normal. We want to normalize deviant behavior. Well, we've tried to normalize ungodly dating practices. But that hasn't gotten rid of all the problems that we see in our families. Look at the lack of understanding and the ignorance. Hosea 4, it hits the nail right on the head. Destroyed for lack of knowledge. Lack of knowledge. Mr. Armstrong, in his book, he said dating procedures have undergone radical changes in the past 75 years. He was writing that in 1981. And he gives some important history about what became modern dating following the wars of the 20th century. If you go back before that time, a lot of the dating was done widely, and there wasn't sexual activity. And the popularity of young men, a lot of it was connected to how social he was, how much he spread himself around. But that began to change, and abruptly so, following World War II. And there are, again, a lot of factors at play here. Mr. Armstrong talks about the avalanche of sex knowledge that became available. You had trends in just the ages for marriage. Of course, we lost a lot of young American men, I think 300,000 in World War II. And then you had the media following that, hyping the fact that we had a male shortage, which didn't help to set the minds of girls at ease. And so more and more of them wanted to hurry and get married, to grab a husband before it was too late. Mr. Armstrong talked about the pitfalls of marrying too young. Well, it wasn't long after that that then this trend of going steady dating And then eventually, like Mr. Armstrong said, that familiarity breeds contempt. In this case, a contempt for purity, sexual purity. And so the guardrails were lowered, and all kinds of other factors and changes have happened since. The automobile, technology, the phones, cable TV, pornography. And you look at dating today in the traditional sense. Again, you have to almost define what you're talking about. Like that study says, those who don't date, it's talking about those who abstain from sexual activity as teens. They're healthier. But then when you look at dating in the traditional sense, like I've described briefly in this segment, that just doesn't go on college campuses today. A young man who would show up and at the gal's dorm, escort her to the car, open the door for her, take her out to dinner or maybe to the park to go on a walk where there's stimulating conversation, and then to escort the girl home. It doesn't happen. Even just the going out to dinner and a movie. Most girls on college campuses today can count how many times that happens in the course of a school year on one hand. It just doesn't happen in the hookup culture. Today, they just hook up for a sexual encounter, and that's it. There is no dating. It's just sexual activity. Well, as I say, at God's college and in God's church, we follow the laws, the rules of dating God's way. Dating the way that will prepare us for marriage. First, the physical marriage, and then the spiritual marriage, the marriage between Christ and the church. The prophet Isaiah, I mentioned the sickness that he refers to in the early chapters of his book. In chapter 55, he talks about the difference between our thoughts and his thoughts. Seek the Lord, it says, while he may be found. Call you upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Eternal, and he will have mercy upon him and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Return to God. Forsake your ways, and even those unrighteous thoughts. He says in verse 8, for my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. We need God's thoughts. We need to think about this subject the way that God thinks about it. And well, all through their AC experience, particularly in Principles of Living, but they've got other courses too, like Mr. Armstrong alludes to in that 1963 letter. They've got marriage and family. They've got all of these messages, all of these lectures, and then all of the experiences, the real world experiences at God's College where they're learning to date God's way. As I was telling the students yesterday, directing the comment, particularly at the men, but it applies to both. But I said to those young men, dating is service. It's a way to give and to serve to the young ladies. And of course, when the young gals reciprocate in conversation and fellowship, both of them giving, and then both of them growing the way that God wants for them to grow. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That's all we have time for on today's program. We thank you for joining us, and we'll see you again tomorrow.